Hello, my name is Dario Balca, student coordinator for the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that UBC's Vancouver Point Grey campus is situated on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. For those listening to this recording outside of this area, I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners and caretakers of those lands. Shauna Olney spent nearly 30 years with the International Labour Organization. Most recently, she served as the ILO's Chief of Gender Equality and Diversity Branch. It's September 1st, 2020, and I have the privilege today of speaking with Shauna about her time as a student at the law school and how it led to an accomplished career in the areas of human rights, equality, and non-discrimination. Shauna, thank you so much for joining me today. Can you tell me a bit about your life before law school and what motivated you to pursue a legal education?
Thanks so much, Dario, and thanks, first of all, for including me. It's really an honor to be part of this very exciting initiative. Life before law school, interesting question. Well, I won't go back too far, but just to say I studied English literature before law, which I really loved. I studied Chaucer, American drama, as much Shakespeare as possible, and that remains one of my great passions. I also took theater classes. And I was very active in the Musical Theatre Society, MUSOC as it was then. In terms of my legal education, it actually goes back quite a ways. I remember being 8 years old and declaring at a family dinner at my grandma's house that I wanted to be a lawyer. So from eight, I was pretty sure that's what I was going to do. And I never doubted it. So I don't know why, but it was just always something that I just knew I wanted to do. We're not a family of lawyers. It's not like we have generations of lawyers, and that was just the natural thing to do. My parents had some lawyer friends, but it wasn't a big part of our life as I was growing up. When I was studying English literature, I also felt a real link to the law, the need to communicate clearly and effectively, both in writing and verbally, to analyze text and to create a narrative that was convincing. So for those people who told me that I should do business and not English before I did law, I actually think English was a really good preparation for law school.
So it was clearly part of your long-term plan to go to law school, which means you must have thought about schools over time. What motivated you to attend the Allard School of Law specifically, and I wonder what some of your first impressions of the school were.
Well, having been born and bred in Vancouver, I also had friends who were attending UBC Law, and of course the UBC Law School had an exceptional reputation. It was quite a natural place for me to go, and I was really excited when I was accepted. I mean, I remember that moment. I was actually sitting at my locker in the arts faculty when I was accepted, and this was a really important moment in my life. When I started at law school, I always remember my first torts and then contract class coming out of it, and I remember exactly where I was on the campus. In fact, it's not very far from where my son actually has a residence now. He's in Ponderosa Commons. Thinking, how do people go through life without studying tort and contract? How is it possible to survive everyday living without knowing the things we learned in class? So I thought everybody should have to take law classes. You know, the law is so practical and it touches us in very real ways. I also remember sitting in the cafeteria and analyzing our first case with some friends and trying to identify the ratio, the obiter dictum. And it seems somewhat daunting at first, but also fascinating. And it really created a camaraderie. This was a puzzle that we were all going to sort out together. And I remember those first classes and those first thoughts actually really well. And that was quite some time ago.
A lot of people who take part in this project talk about their law school experience as a really meaningful one. And I wonder how you reflect on your 3 years there and what some of your most salient memories are during that period.
I remember the work was really intense, but it also meant that we had to support each other among the students. Made some incredible friends who I'm still in touch with today. And I think the law school itself really fostered this really collaborative environment. The work was intense, but so were the friendships that we forged. I also remember a lot of the professors who were really made themselves available, who were ready to talk about issues, and I'm sure that's still the case today. It was a time that I think really shaped how my career moved forward. I also remember things like the Law Review, and I don't know if the Law Review still happens, but we had a musical review every year. And I mean, I think law students are really talented and creative in many ways, and this was a way to get actively involved in writing, singing, acting, to bond as a community, and to let off some steam in a creative way. We did a legal version of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which I think was particularly memorable. In fact, I found the program for it the other day. We just moved house, so I was going through a lot of, walks down memory lane, including law school, just in the last few weeks. So this is a very timely interview.
You had in our conversation before this interview, you had mentioned to me that your family's connection to UBC continues today. Can you tell me a bit about that?
My family connection actually predates my time at UBC and does indeed continue today. Both my parents went to UBC, first in the arts faculty, and then my dad did engineering. My son Nicholas, who was raised in France, did all his schooling in France, primary, secondary. He's now about to start his third year in the Bachelor of Fine Arts program at UBC in the theater program. And he's absolutely loving it. We'd visited a number of UK universities, and he'd been accepted in his top choices. But when we came to Vancouver just before his final year of high school, we just suggested, since we were there, that he do a visit of UBC. And this was one of the life-changing moments, I think, for him. He loved the university. I mean, how can you not fall in love with the campus? Again, that's one of my earliest memories, was looking out at the ocean and thinking, wow, you get to go to university and look out at that view. But the campus itself is so beautiful. But he also was really taken by the approach to student care. So there was the whole package really attracted him. So he applied for the BFA program. He had a first audition and an interview, and then was called back and was accepted into the program. And there were, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of kids who had auditioned. But during his interview, he told us they'd asked him why he wanted to go to UBC. And one of the reasons he gave was that he would be the third generation in his family to go to UBC. And that was really meaningful to him. And he's, as I said before, he's absolutely loving it. So I'm really excited that he's continuing the tradition.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I want to talk now a little bit about your career, which seems to have focused mainly on areas such as labor, human rights, gender equality. What sparked your interest in these topics initially?
Well, I come from a family with a strong labor and social justice background. My mother, in particular, has been a major influence in my life and has always supported and encouraged my educational and professional choices, as has my father, and my grandmother was another major influence in my life. There's a strong human rights core to labor law, and we see this embodied in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Freedom of association, freedom of expression, freedom of peaceful assembly. These rights also support the enjoyment of so many other rights, including equality and non-discrimination. And I learned about the Charter at UBC. I remember the Charter was pretty new back then. And I was really fascinated and awed by it. This was such an amazing, powerful instrument that we were just discovering the boundaries of at that time. For me, the Charter brought labor and human rights together, And it's also what made me want to clerk for the Supreme Court of Canada, which I was fortunate enough to have been able to do. So law school was really, really key to awakening that interest and showing the intersection between labor and human rights for me.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned clerking for the Supreme Court of Canada, which is quite an accomplishment and a privilege. I wonder what that experience was like and what you took away from it.
It was intense. We worked all the time. It was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life, and I would encourage anybody who has the opportunity to clerk at whatever level to do it. You get a real insight into how decisions are made. You're also put together with people who you can debate and discuss and stimulate each other. We were 18 people in one room. In the clerk's room, and it was dynamic, to say the least. When I was there, it was the time when some of the very first major charter cases were reaching the Supreme Court of Canada, so we had a role in debating those and in discussing those with our judges and being part of that process. I worked for Justice Laforet, and he was also a real mentor for me. He gave me a lot of advice about my studies, about which lawyers I should watch argue, and many other things. So also from that perspective, it was really important. The clerks that I worked with, we were each other's family. So it was very intense from a work perspective, but also in terms of the relationships that were created. I was on a business trip to Ottawa last year. And I hadn't been to Ottawa for many, many years. And I walked around the court for the first time in a long, long time. And it brought back a lot of really, really powerful memories. It was an extraordinary time. But I also took the opportunity to get in touch with one of the people I had clerked with. And that's Justice Nicolas Cazirer, who's now a Supreme Court of Canada judge himself. And we're all very, very proud of his appointment.
I know that you worked as a barrister and solicitor in Canada before joining the ILO in 1991. Can you describe some of your early work as a lawyer and how you came to be involved with the ILO?
I was really lucky when I started in the law firm. I worked with Ladner Downs, which is now Borden Ladner Gervais, as well as Clark Wilson. And charter work was really new then. And so it's not like now when I think half the lawyers in the firm are fighting to do charter work. I had firsthand experience with charter cases at the court. So I worked in the labor law unit, and as a young associate was already working on appeal cases and appealing and appearing before arbitration panels, mainly arguing charter issues. And, for a new lawyer now, I think that would be probably unheard of. But it was an exceptional time. And as I say, I was extremely lucky. I discovered the ILO when I was at Oxford in my labor law courses. And here was a place that brought together my great loves, labor and human rights. And so I applied for a summer internship when I was at Oxford or when I was finishing up at Oxford, and I'm still here. So it was being at the right place at the right time, an opportunity that opened up, and in an organization that was really the embodiment of what I was most passionate about. Mm.
And of course, you spent a large portion of your career there now. Can you describe some of the roles that you've held in those years and maybe what some of your responsibilities are as the current Chief of Gender Equality and Diversity?
Sure. Well, in the 28 years that I've been here, I've had a lot of different roles. And that's the great thing about being a lawyer, having a legal background. You can do so many things. And that's certainly proven true in my time at the ILO. So I've worked in a number of different departments, in a number of different roles. I've worked on ILO foundational issues, so on freedom of association, collective bargaining, social dialogue, which are really at the core of our work, both from a technical perspective, including drafting labor laws, doing training, writing on these issues, as well as on the treaty compliance side. I was also head of the equality team in the International Labor Standards Department, responsible for a number of issues, including non-discrimination, equal pay, migrant workers, indigenous peoples, HIV and AIDS. And that, again, was on the normative side, so looking at treaty compliance. I was also the ILO's human rights coordinator, interacting regularly with the UN system, the treaty bodies, the UN interagency groups. And that was an interesting experience as well, because the ILO is a little bit of a special animal within the UN system. So we're the only tripartite organization. So we have workers, employers, and governments on our governance structures. So it's a very different dynamic. It also makes it very exciting because you have the actors of the real economy there also negotiating with the governments, and they bring their own perspectives, which I think are so interesting. And in the UN system, and we are a UN agency, but because we're a little bit different, it was important to be able to show that we also deal with human rights. So that labor rights, many of the labor rights are in fact human rights. And so that was one of my roles as the human rights coordinator, to really bring the voice of the ILO into the UN system. I was just going to move on to my present role as the chief of the Gender Equality and Diversity Branch, which I've had for almost 7 years. At that time, the ILO was reorganizing, and they brought together the technical work on different areas into one branch so that equality and non-discrimination could be addressed in a more holistic manner. So at one time we had disability in one area, we had Indigenous in another, we had HIV in another. Gender was really a bureau looking a lot at the internal processes within the ILO. So all that was brought together to be able to strengthen the technical capacity on equality and non-discrimination. So we look at respect, we look at gender equality, disability, HIV, Indigenous and ethnic minorities, racialized groups, LGBTI. And we also see that manifestations of discrimination change, and we see that in the COVID context as well. So discrimination based on COVID status is something else that we've started to look at. In terms of a couple of recent initiatives, the ILO is the oldest organization in the UN family. We actually came out of the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. And as I said, it's the only tripartite organization, so it has a little bit of a different dynamic. Last year, as you can tell, it was 2019, 100 years after we were founded, we had been preparing for our centenary for a number of years before, really wanting to look at what do we want the future of work to look like. So we had to reflect on the past, really take stock of the present, and look to the future. And one of the areas where our Director General really wanted us to dig deep was in terms of women at work. We knew that progress for women in the world of work had been extremely slow. If we look at gender gaps on some of the main indicators, labor indicators, access to jobs, pay, leadership, and others, we see that the difference between men and women has not really changed. That gender gap has been quite stagnant. In some cases, I mean, the leadership gap, it hasn't moved for over 30 years. So clearly something was going wrong. And it was time to reflect on what we needed to do. So we launched the Women at Work Centenary Initiative, and I was, you know, very fortunate to lead that initiative. And we put together a whole program of action to try to understand what was happening, to get a snapshot of the situation, to look at the policies, to try to see how we could accelerate progress. So this was a five-year process, and we did some very innovative research, including new data and research that we did with Gallup, the polling company, to understand what women really wanted in the world of work. So were we making assumptions about what women wanted? Did they really want to work in paid jobs? And the answer is yes. The majority of women across the globe in every region want to work in paid jobs. And what is the biggest obstacle? It's care responsibilities. So that really gave us some leverage to move forward on issues around care. Another issue that came up in the polling was unequal pay, and violence and harassment and discrimination came up as well. So those became really the pillars of our work, and we really dug deep into those issues.
You're talking about the Centenary Initiative, and I know that I was reading a bit about how this, as a result of that group's work, this idea of the right to a world free from violence and a working world free from violence and harassment being articulated in a treaty for the first time. Could you elaborate a little bit on that and why it's such an important milestone?
Well, thanks for raising that. That's one of my favorite topics. Last year, marking our centenary celebrations, the ILO adopted a new treaty, Convention 190 on Ending Violence and Harassment in the World of Work. And I'd been leading this work for over 5 years, and it was the first new convention the ILO had adopted since 2011. So this was something really significant. And just to point out the role of Canada, obviously I was involved in the secretariat side, leading that work, but Canada was at the center of this process in many ways. The chair of our committee was from the Canadian government, as well as the spokesperson for the workers group. So when we're negotiating the treaty, you have the government group that they speak separately as governments, but the workers group will normally speak with one voice, and so will the employers group. So the representative of the workers group was from the Canadian Labour Congress, and the Canadian government was also really active in the discussions. So as you said, for the first time, there's a treaty that provides the right of everyone to a world of work free from violence and harassment. And I think that's something that we should all be proud of, everyone who was involved in that process. We have an agreed framework. We have a global mandate. And what's interesting is this whole process started before the Me Too movement. So obviously, you know, it culminated last year, but the decision to put it on the agenda of the conference for standard setting for both a convention and a recommendation happened before Me Too. So the workers, employers, and government had decided that this issue was so important that it really should be considered for a new treaty. So the ILO was really ahead of the curve on that. But I think it couldn't be more timely, since we've seen a real spike in violence and harassment in the COVID context. We've seen frontline workers who have been subject to violence. We've seen a spike in domestic violence. And for many people, the workplace is their home with the lockdowns and a lot of the teleworking that's going on. So I think it's really important that we move forward the ratification and implementation of this convention.
As you mentioned, 28 years with the ILO, it's a long time to spend with one organization. You've clearly held a variety of roles and taken on a variety of challenges, but I wonder what it is that you ultimately find rewarding about the work that you've done there and what's kept you there over the years.
I think being able to move around to see different aspects of the organization's work has been really important, because they all link together and one builds on the other. So that I've really enjoyed. And again, it's something I would encourage people to do, just not to stay still. I mean, even if you're in the same organization, to be able to see all the different angles. What's always struck me about our work is that it touches issues that affect us every day. Our right to be free from discrimination, our right to be free from violence and harassment, our right to associate, our right to organize. We have a body of 190 treaties, so it's the biggest body of international law in the UN system. And it is very practical. So these are the rights that are negotiated by workers, employers, and governments, and really grounded in the realities on the ground across the globe. Of course, being part of creating international law was extremely exciting with the new treaty last year. I think that was certainly a highlight, and something that will continue. I mean, once that convention is ratified, once the implementation takes place, it's going to make real change on the ground, and we see that with our standard system. We have a supervisory system that's very strong, where there's a dialogue with governments on compliance. Workers and employers also contribute to that supervisory process. We also work with workers, employers, and governments on the ground to implement those rights and principles. So making sure they're practically applied. So we have that whole range. We go from the, you know, the highest level of international law and then translating that on the ground in very real laws, policies, and measures. So for me, it's the values and principles of the organization that have kept me here and will, I think, continue to influence whatever work I do moving forward.
Hmm. Last year, you were recognized by Apolitical as one of the world's 100 most influential people in gender policy. What does it mean to you to be recognized in that way?
Well, it was certainly an honor, and I can tell you it was a surprise. I still have no idea who nominated me. Apparently, there were 9,000 nominations. So I was, yes, deeply honored. I think it's a tribute to the many people I've worked with in the ILO who in recent years have really pushed the boundaries to challenge assumptions, to really work courageously in new areas, to dig deep into issues that maybe weren't as popular. The care economy was perhaps not as interesting to people, but we were able to show just how relevant that was and do a really deep dive into that area, have new research, have new data that really, I think, helped to change the narrative, just as our work with Gallup did. We've, I think, together made the ILO really visible in this area. One of my colleagues just this morning told me that having been named as one of the most influential people in gender policy, I had an obligation to use that influence. So it was really interesting that we had that conversation just today. And I agree with her. I think it does give her responsibility, and it is something that I certainly aim to do in any way that I can.
I know that you've also authored and co-authored a number of publications on some of the topics we've been talking about today, so gender equality, non-discrimination. How does your work as an author tie into the change that you've tried to create over the course of your career?
I think we often underestimate how much we learn in the work that we do. And it's important that we capture that, because sometimes, you know, we're working in great depth on a topic, and we know that work really, really well, but we don't necessarily share it in an accessible manner. We use it in lots of different ways, but I think when you can encapsulate it into an article, into a book, into something that will attract different audiences, and also help to change the discourse, help to create a debate or a dialogue, it is really important. It's part of a creative cycle. So in writing the article or the book itself, it also helps you reflect and I think hone some of your thinking. So for me, it's been a really important process for that. I recently wrote an article for the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London, and I'm on the board of that institute. And the article was on gender equality in the COVID-19 era and beyond. So I wrote this right in the middle of the crisis. And it was an opportunity to raise the alarm, I think, because COVID in many places is putting at risk what was already fragile progress on gender equality. And I think it was important to articulate that. And so the Global Institute was a good venue to do that. So I think it's an opportunity in many ways to do it in a timely fashion where you can influence the debate.
I wanted to go back a little bit to this, to your experience with legal education, because I think that we've tried to kind of trace your story from your time as a student to some of the most recent work that you've been doing. And I think it's definitely not a typical path for ILO graduates necessarily. So I wonder how your own experience and your own journey
makes you reflect on the value of legal education, maybe the breadth of opportunities that it affords those who receive it.
Well, I'll tell anybody who will listen that a legal education is invaluable. It does open up enormous opportunities. When I was in the standards department, the International Labor Standards Department of the ILO, I was doing very legal work. So we were doing treaty compliance. But all the other jobs I've had in the ILO, all the other positions, have been multidisciplinary. So, but I think as a lawyer, you bring those analytical skills, you're able to see the nuances in arguments, in different documents. And I think it does open up opportunities. You're able to see the big picture. You're able to argue a position, whether in writing or orally, in a convincing way. And these are the skills that you need for almost any work. So I think it's a great background for just about anything people want to do. And certainly in the international community, it's extremely valuable.
As law students, where it feels like a lot of the preparation we're receiving, both inside the classroom and outside of it, is really tailored to getting us to be practicing lawyers out of school. If someone did want to take a somewhat more different path and work with international law or international organizations or in some of the areas that you've focused on, do you have any advice for what they maybe should be doing as students that could help them get there?
I think a lot of the foundation courses are really important. You know, learning about the basics of contract, tort, criminal law, labor law, I mean, property law, all those things somehow interact later on in different ways. I mean, I've been really surprised actually in my career how much I've pulled on that knowledge, and not just on the labor law side, but you'll also get issues where the contractual situation comes up or other issues. So you can see how different areas of the law intersect, as they often do. They don't, the law seldom exists in silos. So I think really focus on those areas, really get grounded in the basics, and then you can move forward into more specialized areas and do what you love. Do what you're passionate about. You know, if you're working, I would say 8 hours a day, but I know as lawyers, none of us or those in the law never work 8 hours a day. And in the court, it was more like 20. Work hard. Learn as much as you can from the people around you, from your studies. Read as widely as you can. But talk, discuss, spark each other. And I'd also say ask people to mentor you. I had mentors all through my career. And some of them were formal, some of them were informal. But just somebody you can bounce things off, somebody who can guide you, but also somebody you can give your thoughts to. And, you know, we all have a lot to share and a lot of great ideas. So continue to give those in any work that you do. And if you're interested in clerking, as I said before, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And I think that's really valuable. Again, my clerking experience is something I've drawn on in the ILO as well. So nothing you do is wasted. I think every experience is a valuable one. And just get out there and take in as much as you can. The road might not be straight. And be open to opportunities, because they're there. Sometimes you just have to look a little harder.
We've talked a lot about work over the last half hour or so, but part of this project is really about getting to know our alumni. Could you tell me a bit about what you're passionate outside of your role with the ILO and what we've been talking about?
Part of what I'm passionate about also links to ILO. I've been really fortunate to be able to travel a lot in my work, but also personally. And I think whenever you go to a new country, you meet new people, you learn so much. And it helps to overcome assumptions. So I think traveling has been wonderful. We're probably doing a little less of that, at least in the near future. So I feel very grateful to have had those opportunities. I love music. I love theater. Both acting and watching plays. We've been very close to London here, and so we've been able to go over and see a lot of theatre, and that's been really lovely. I'm absolutely passionate about anything to do with Shakespeare, Shakespeare in plays. I read a lot about Shakespeare. I love singing. My son is the talent in that area, the singer, the actor, the musician, but it's also something that's always been, they've always been great passions for me as well. And what I love most is actually being able to sing with my son. That's, that's something that's been really special.
Yeah. You're clearly someone who likes to keep very busy. Are there any projects or roles coming up in your future that you're excited about and would like to share?
I think you're quite right. I'm somebody who always has a plan. I know what I want to be doing. I'm usually at the next step, but I like to have a plan, know how to move forward. Right now, I don't really have a plan. My big plan is I've decided to return to Canada. COVID, I think, has made a lot of us reflect. And certainly for me and my family, we've decided it's time to be closer to our Canadian family. Vancouver seems very far away right now. Travel is very difficult. And I've been at the ILO for 28 years. So the team is really well positioned. The convention is gaining momentum. I feel it's a good time to leave as well, from a professional point of view, to really leave feeling that I've done something useful and that the team will continue to go from strength to strength. So the decision to retire happened quickly. So I'll be taking early retirement. I don't know what I'm going to do at the end of the year when I leave the ILO. But I'd really like to use the experience, the values and principles of the ILO to make a contribution, whether that's at the local level, the national level, I don't know. But I'm going to be open to what the universe brings. And for the first time probably ever, I don't have a clear plan, but somehow COVID has made that okay. So I'm excited about going home. And the more I travel, the more I'm convinced that Vancouver is the most beautiful place in the world. And it's time to go home.
Yeah, we definitely are very lucky to be able to call this home. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been really fascinating.
Thank you.